And we're good.
One of the things I recall from many, many years ago, I think probably when I was a student or a very junior faculty person, I can remember Harry Shoemaker, who was then the chairman of the surgery department, saying that one of the things which he felt most important was to teach medical students how to think like doctors. And I never knew what he meant. As time passed, I think I know what he meant, the full scope of what he meant, but I'm not sure. I don't think you can put it in one sentence. But there is one, a necessity to deal with incomplete information and not to be frightened by incomplete information, but to know a series of routes to make it less incomplete and make it satisfactorily manageable. And how to do that requires a constant interaction with the patient while questioning in the back of your mind, what is going on here and how can I develop this further? It's sort of like a historian interviewing somebody. What is going on here and how can I make it more complete? But you're dealing then with live people, the patients, and that has other kinds of burdens. In a sense, you entered into a contract with society to provide certain kinds of attitudes and services, but you do it in an incomplete and inadequately organized world, and the question is how to solve the problems which are presented there. Now, that's the essence of the educational problem in medicine, how to get people how to handle that. And they have to have a vast amount of information, recognizing that information will change over time. Quite a number of years ago now, I was asked to give a lecture. This was when I was chairman of medicine. Asked to give a lecture to the beginning pharmacology class on anything I wanted to talk about. And what I did in preparation was go to the hospital and pull out 50 charts and simply make a list of the medications which the patients were taking, and then remember, or try to remember, how many of those I'd even heard about when I was a medical student, and it was maybe 10%. Well, those are new facts, and this was a long time ago, and there's a lot more new facts since that time. But the problem-solving issue, problem-solving as it relates to a patient who presents a problem, hadn't changed an awful lot. You have different techniques, but otherwise, that's what I think the educational process is about.
It seems from your comments that, I mean, one of the fundamental balancing acts in medical education, and seemingly more so in the late 20th century and to the 21st, is that the human dynamic of the relationship between the sufferer and the healer and kind of getting the history and taking the, you know, and sort of the first approach to the patient and their body and their condition, seems relatively fixed and unchanging, bodies being bodies. At the same time, the arsenal of tools and approaches, either diagnostic or therapeutic, that are available is exploding, as you say, with your list of medicines. And it seems like one of the challenges medical education faces is to balance between understanding what we know and understanding what we don't know. That is, whatever the latest new gorillacillin may be.
Yeah, well, that's right. But I think also the question, what would you like to know?
Mm-hmm.
What facts would you like to have in order to solve this problem?
Mm-hmm. So in many cases, it sounds like what you're trying to teach is a particular kind of judgment.
Yeah. Except that's hard to do.
But I was going to say, how do you institutionalize judgment?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if you can't institutionalize judgment, what's the next best thing if you're training someone to be a doctor?
I don't know the answer to that. It sounds rather hopeless to me. I suppose what happens is people immerse themselves in facts and end up with a a smaller and smaller field of attack so that they have more and more manageable facts and questions. Mm-hmm. Hence specialization.
And the seemingly endless challenge for internists and
That's
people
right.
in primary care. To take it back to your experiences at the medical school, in what ways did you think, well, when you looked out, let's take the time when you're appointed as dean of the medical school. So now we're in the 1980s, and one of your primary responsibilities is the making of new doctors. And you're on top of a very large and very heterogeneous organization. How did you think about it at the time in terms of, were you satisfied with the way that doctors were being trained at IU? Did you see any particular educational goals? These are the things we need to do to improve or to continue the growth and development of medical education in Indiana.
Well, I can recall thinking that, first of all, I thought we did a good job. And I measured that feeling of good job by the fact that I didn't think we were surrounded by bad doctors. So in a totally non-objective manner, I thought we were doing a good job. I didn't know how to make it more objective. You get better examination instruments and things of that sort, but that really didn't solve the problem. It seemed to me that there were two fundamental things that as an institution we ought to do. One was to deepen and broaden the research activities of the school. Deepen, that is to say, make it more intense, and broaden in the sense of making it more intense in more and more disciplines. And the other thing that we ought to do was to increase the personal contacts of teachers with students, smaller and smaller groups, more and more emphasis on problem solving. I thought if we could do both of those things, the educational situation would improve. I thought one of our problems was that we had too many students for the size of our clinical opportunity. There were too many patients, too many students clustered around a patient's bedside at any particular time for adequate instruction. So we had to do, I thought, two things. One was to examine the numbers of students, and two, examine the numbers of clinical teaching opportunities. So we set out to do both of those. And over a period of several years, decreased the number of students. And then increased the clinical opportunities by extending them to a number of other places. And I think that was a good move. Furthermore, over time, the big lecture room, although we didn't do away with them by any means, but they began to be supplemented more and more by small discussion groups clustered around the big lecture room. And I think that was beneficial. I thoroughly believed in the nationalization of examinations, the so-called National Board Examination, because I thought that was the way we could standardize our own feelings about how we were doing with respect to other medical schools across the country. So that became a very serious requirement for students. And they responded very well.
So this is a very naive, I'm not a doctor question about becoming a doctor. And you can two ways to answer this. One is sort of in the ideal, this is what should be happening. Two is in my experience, here's what happens. When you're a medical student, before you get your MD, what should you be learning and how should you be learning it? What's the important part of that? And then what's different when you're a resident? And you know, what should you be learning as a resident?
Well, with respect to the medical student issue, that's an awfully hard question to give a succinct answer to. I have the feeling, if I could have my way, it would be a question which wouldn't be answered. And what I would tell the student is, I don't care what you're learning. I would rather you run as fast as you can and bite off as much as you can, and I'll be happy, providing you're doing both of those. On the other hand, we are a discipline with broad information requirements, more than just letting people run into narrow worlds. So you do have to have some definition of minimal learning in certain areas. But the main thing I would want is for the students to, as I said, run as fast as they can and bite off as much as they can. And providing they've got some bare bones across the board, I won't really care what it is. Now, for residents, the world has already gotten narrower because those are specialty oriented to some degree or other. And I take essentially the same position, recognizing that out there in the world is a certifying examination in that specialty, which they are going to have to pass. And I don't want them to fail, but they're going to have to pass it. I'm not going to have to pass it for them.
When you were serving as dean, one of the things that you've talked about previously is the importance of, as you said earlier, deepening and broadening the research activity. And previously you've talked about the importance of otolaryngology in the sort of early, as a sort of almost an exemplar of how to make new kinds of research happen, how to expand the research agenda. And I wonder if you could share some of your sort of sense of what was going on in that department, in otolaryngology, in that area, that was so valuable, and to what degree did it become sort of an exemplar for this? Is
the ENT department is old. I guess it historically is not the first specialty to develop in this country. I think ophthalmology was that. But anyway, it's old and has done, has a long and distinguished history of producing good to superior practitioners of the art, the surgical specialty. And there's just no question about that. They've done good people for 100 years or almost. Across the country, small surgical departments have not been successful at doing research other than the accumulation of numbers of patients and deducing what's good and bad and what wrinkles there are in treatment, which is better. That's not something which is peculiar to us here. It's national and it's characteristic of all surgical departments to an extent, because the development of investigators in a medical discipline depends upon having people not only motivated but have the opportunity to spend a considerable amount of their time learning how to do it, the research I mean. And if it takes 5 or 6 years after medical school to learn the surgical discipline and the techniques involved, there's not much time left in life to spend another X number of years learning how to get new information. That's one of their particular challenges. Well, anyway, we had opportunism at work. Had a donor who was very much interested in providing funding for laboratories for and ongoing research for hearing, and had a young faculty member who was very bright and very well motivated, and had a good start at doing hearing research. He then became the new chairman, and he's got one of the most active research-oriented ENT departments in the country. Luck.
And as a dean, when those lucky moments happen, are there things that you did? Are there things that a dean?
Sure. I saw to it that he had space and money.
Mm-hmm. And are those your most? Are those the most powerful tools that a dean has?
He doesn't have much else. Mm-hmm. You got the power of your tongue,
mm-hmm.
the power of persuasion, but the power of the purse and the power of real estate is all else.
Being that real estate is a fixed asset, they're not making much more of it.
We're making a lot of it recently.
Mm-hmm. And was that a priority during your time as well?
Yeah, except there wasn't any money to do it with.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to grow a research program, it's not going to happen without space. Now, you can reassign, if you've got a little space, you can reassign it, or you can remodel this or something, but nothing substantial is going to happen. But if you want jumps in research activities, you need new space. And that is, the current dean would not say it's easy, but it's easier than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. And with a limited amount of space, how did you do the work of keeping and attracting the new people to broaden and deepen the research?
Well, you can't get new people mm-hmm. under those circumstances, except as replacements.
Mm-hmm.
And in a system where you can't fire people, that's kind of tough. There is natural attrition, and when that occurs, there's opportunity. Now, if you get a new building, then you, and presuming you can scare up money to pay the people, you've got an opportunity for growth.
And when you grow when you get those opportunities, what does successfully expanding the research program within the medical school, how does that, does it transform the training of doctors directly, and if so, where do you see that?
I believe it does, but the linkage is not 1, 2, 3, 4. But I think you've got really two choices from an educational point of view. One is that you communicate facts and techniques and means of solving the problems at hand. And the other alternative is that you develop an atmosphere which is constantly seeking questions and trying to find ways to answer questions on a much broader and more fundamental way. And I think that works best if the people the student is working with are accustomed to doing that in their own research, so that every patient becomes a research question. Now, that doesn't mean you're monkeying around experimenting on people, but it's an intellectual exercise. And that, I think, is one of the important benefits of medical education in a research environment.
When you had those responsibilities at the medical school, who within, what positions within the medical school and also outside of it were sort of your most important collaborators in terms of if you wanted to bring change to the medical school?
Well, in my case, I had different deans do this different mm-hmm. medical school. I won't speak about other deans right. in a university because I don't know anything about their problems. But other medical school deans that would do it differently. In my case, I relied upon, for this issue, two kinds of people. I got had, again, serendipity, two very important associate deans. One was an associate dean for research, who I selected because he is himself an outstanding investigator, and also one who organizes his time and activities very well. And the other was a very experienced person who had worked for some time at NIH and was very versatile in administration. So that person then became sort of the associate dean for fixing difficult problems, and the other dean, other associate dean, became the associate dean for research. And they're both highly successful people, and I was delighted to bask in their reflected light.
And if one has an associate dean for difficult problems, what kind of difficult problems need to be tasked to such a dean? That is, what were the difficult problems?
Well, you can make a list of the political problems of the day. Mm-hmm. Political, not Republican, Democrat, but political. For example, the accreditation of animal facilities for research. That's not an easy thing to deal with, but it all of a sudden became very easy to deal with. The organization of faculty mentoring and structures of that sort fell into place pretty well. In the case of the research situation, I asked for a survey of our research inadequacies, which was developed, specific fields, I mean. And then the notion was that as we had the opportunity to replace people in specific disciplines, the chairman of those departments would find it much easier to replace them if they fell into where our inadequacies were. And that was very helpful, very useful.
Do you, from this distance, have recollection of what are the most significant gaps?
Yeah. Now, this would have been in 1984, something like that. One was neurobiology, and the other was molecular biology.
And those were the two sort of areas. Did you feel that by the time your term as dean ended, that you had started to fill those gaps?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People still are working on it.
Right.
There's a whole building.
That's right. That's right. It's evident. Maybe this. Let's see if this is germane or not. But it just popped my head when you were talking about molecular biology, which is old Myers Hall in Bloomington is now Center for Molecular Biology Research. Does How as a dean do you manage the, you know, the sort of intra-institutional relationships, in the sense that if IU Bloomington, to take an example, is fostering the growth of molecular biology research, how does the medical school at the same time sort of make sure that its needs in the same area are being dealt with?
Well, now we fall into a situation which I think you probably ought to talk with Craig Brader about,
mm-hmm.
Because that's a contemporary issue which wasn't there, mm-hmm. When I was coming along. So I really can't.
And there weren't an analogs to that at the time, where they were, this is sort of a life sciences problem created by the sort of convergence.
Opportunities which are available.
Right.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Reasonable enough. When you were dean, to go back to a topic we've talked about earlier in a different time period, which is how were the relations with the hospitals here at the medical center, that is Wishard and VA, and had the kinds of improvements that had been hoped for in the 70s come to pass?
VA was and is sometimes difficult to understand. At the physician level, we have had for 50-some years here a very close relationship. In many cases, the physicians at the VA are ones we appointed with the VA's blessing. The thing which is in the background, however, is that the Veterans Administration has an absentee landlord, and that absentee landlord owns, and quite rightly, feels it operates its hospital, and controls its budget, and now and then expresses its pleasure or displeasure, as the case may be. When personnel change in the building in Washington, sometimes you have to renegotiate the relationships. The hospital has an administrator who is delegated with total control from Washington. On the other hand, all of the medical schools of the country where there is a Veterans Hospital have a negotiated relationship with the Veterans Administration, which recognizes mutual benefits, and we usually are able to carry that off perfectly well. In my own experience, now and then, I'd have to pack a bag and go to Washington and talk to the people there. But by and large, both as a student and as a resident and all the way along the line, the VA was very important to our institution and education. For a while, I was concerned that the VA hospital might cease to be, because veterans were aging and dying, and they didn't seem to be making any more. That doesn't seem to be a problem now. And I think as they continue to make more veterans, it'll be just as important or increasingly important, mm-hmm. in our overall economy. And by economy, I don't mean money. Mm-hmm. Our overall economy. Wishard Hospital has also an absentee landlord, except he's downtown. They are downtown. And we have, I think, a much closer relationship with Wishart Hospital. And that's because of the nature of the management contract we have with Wishart Hospital, which went through several iterations, but was negotiated during the time I was either chairman or dean or watched mm-hmm. it happen. And I think things have settled down administratively so that it has a good prospect for the future. The problem about Wishart is money, and most of the big city hospitals like Wishart in the country failed long ago and went out of business. In fact, some of them, the buildings aren't even there anymore. Mm-hmm. This one hasn't, and I think we're one of the reasons it hasn't. I think it's a very good relationship mutually. I think it's absolutely essential to the educational program of the medical school, at least as that educational program is currently understood. And you had another, the IU hospitals. Mm-hmm. Well, that's probably more of a problem than it used to be, but I can't speak to okay. how it is right now. But the way it used to be, once a week, I had a meeting in the dean's office with the administrator of the university hospital and with an associate dean, different one, who was in charge of hospitals, mm-hmm. and that's where we did our business. The university trustees were the trustees of the university mm-hmm. hospital, and there weren't any problems there. Mm-hmm. If there were, they've got a new administrator. Which didn't have to happen. Sometimes the university was slow to understand the problems of the hospital, understandably so, because the university trustees were busy being responsible for the university, and all of a sudden, vast cash fluxes were going on in hospitals, and that was very threatening to them. But anyway, the world's different now.
In the contract with Wishart, and think about it from the medical school's perspective, why was that contract important to the medical school? Now this is, you know, in the the 1980s. That is, one way to characterize this is, why did the School of Medicine need to be at Wishart in that kind of way for the medical school?
Well, let's back up just a little mm-hmm. further in the concept. I said a while ago that I thought that in the current understanding of the educational program of the medical school, Wishart was absolutely essential. Let me enlarge on that then. I think Wishart provides two very important things. One, we could not adequately teach the clinical We cannot adequately meet the clinical needs of our students without Wishart Hospital. We simply need that number of patients. That's one. The other is that Wishart provides a particular kind of patient, which is very important to the educational opportunity. I'd already mentioned the general unsorted nature of the patients, and that's very important. I believe the social circumstances of the patients there is very important for the medical students. Medical students, by and large, not exclusively, but by and large, come from a middle class, upper middle class families who have come up on the both going to college financially, and some, most have not. And most of them have never seen a poor person in their lives, and have very little understanding of what that means. And I believe it's terribly important in the education of physicians that they understand what that means and what the health burdens of that population are, and what the social contract the physician has with society that includes dealing with that kind of patient population, dealing constructively with that patient population. I believe that's very important. Anyway, so based on those two considerations, which is very important, the educational burden of the institution. Now then, that being the case, in what kind of an environment do you want to educate your students? When I was a student, Wishard City Hospital was, frankly, I thought it was abominable. It was not a place that patients should be. Consequently, it was not a place that students should be. As time passed, it was better, but it still was not appropriate. I believe the easiest way to make it appropriate is to be professionally responsible for it. And then if it's not good, it's not good for the patients. It's not good for the students, and it's our fault.
And that one of the terms of phrases that has gotten used in documentation, and I'm certain it goes back at least to the late 70s, in one form or another, is this idea that there is one standard of care for all patients who have an IU doctor.
I think that's too broad a statement, but I certainly do subscribe to that. Mm-hmm. The reason I think it's too broad a statement is you have to define what care is and what that standard of care is. The world in general tends to equate what I think of as the hotel quality with standard of care. And I don't see that as where the action is. Some people go to Holiday Inn, and some people go to Four Seasons hotels. And I don't think that has to be one standard of care. Mm-hmm. But I think when you make the initial contact with the medical system, you ought to have equivalent chances of getting well. That's what's meant by standard of care. Mm-hmm. I subscribe to it totally.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the school of medicine at the time has to have, are there other ways to manage the relationships, like, you know, with Wishard you have the contract, that ensure that your students are always learning in the kinds of environments that the medical school is comfortable with, that meets its sort of standards? Other than the sort of contractual relationship.
Well, sure, you could own it.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you own it, you assume financial risk. And we went that route. And actually, we went that route, and our lawyers told us that we couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. But be that as it may. Yeah, you could take it on faith, which wouldn't work for very long. You could have some rent relationship. You could have some friendly handshake relationship. But that does, none of those things provide permanence.
Mm-hmm.
A contractual management relationship, although that's not permanent, seems to provide the best hope of permanence.
with the increasing importance of outpatient medicine in medical education and the sort of explosion in the number of clinical faculty, was there ever any issue about, was there ever a problem or considered a matter of concern about ensuring that if we have students in more different kinds of locations in the community than we used to have, about what kinds of learning and what they're being taught by the clinical faculty that they're having experience with?
Yeah, sure. Concern about that. But you get around that. By enlarging on what I was saying earlier, I don't believe that medical students have to have cookie cutter experiences. They have to have rich experiences dealing with patient medical problems under the supervision of physicians who are capable and want to participate in the treatment. And for accreditation purposes, we keep, or are supposed to keep anyway, patient diaries, that is, student diaries with descriptions and lists of patients and so on, to demonstrate the scope of patient problems, but those diaries don't have to be identified. Just shouldn't reflect student X has nothing but